This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 13th of September. Sir Keir Starmer and Joe Biden meet in Washington. President Putin's warning of a wider war has put on the agenda whether Ukraine should be permitted to use the long-range weapons that America and Britain supply to hit targets inside Russia. We'll hear what Ukrainian soldiers think about and how they follow this debate closely. The courts forced the British government to think again on what would be the first deep coal mine opened for 30 years. Can the country grow its economy if it refuses to exploit its fossil fuel reserves when other countries are exploiting theirs? A news conference from space. Well, if you were stuck up there for months longer than expected, how else would you relieve the boredom? Stephen McDonnell reports on the growth of soccer in China. Hard graft on the plantation, in the home and on the street. A new exhibition explores the impact on the health of manual, often marginalised workers. And Harry Duke of Sussex says he's excited about turning 40, not anxious as he was about turning 30. So how is marking the decades passing changing our perspective? Stay with me for that discussion. You're listening to The World Tonight with Sean Lay.
Do you take that threat seriously?
The pool spray in the White House this evening, nothing to do with the Rose Garden, is the phrase used by journalists to describe the brief access given in the last hour to Sir Keir Starmer and Joe Biden exchanging pleasantries. The spray provides TV cameras and stills photographers with material for reporters to use to describe a meeting that is strictly behind closed doors. As they sat down in the White House before the media were instructed to leave, the president addressed Sir Keir. The Prime Minister replied in similar vein.
Mr. President, thank you very much for those words. Thank you for the invitation to be back here just 2 months after our last meeting here. And it's really important to us, great allies, that special relationship, have this time to talk about the global issues you have just identified, starting, of course, with Ukraine, where I think the next few weeks and months will be crucial. Very, very important that we support Ukraine in this vital war of freedom.
The message for the wider world, perhaps especially for the Kremlin, we're on the same page. President Vladimir Putin's warning of a wider war if the UK and US give Ukraine consent to use long-range weapons to hit targets inside Russia would have been hard for this meeting to ignore. In a few moments, we'll hear from our political editor, Chris Mason, who's in Washington, D.C., and ask a former commanding general of US Army in Europe, would permission to fire those missiles at targets inside Russia make a difference? But first, the view from the territory at the heart of the matter. Patrick Yarach is a photojournalist who's covered the war in Ukraine since Russia began its full-scale invasion 2.5 years ago. He says Ukrainians pay close attention to any Western discussion on weapons. Patrick is just back from Pokrovsk, the small city in the Donbas, which has been subjected to heavy bombardment by Russia and which has today had its water supplies cut off.
It's a city that used to be alive just a couple months ago, so it changed very quickly. Now it's emptying very fast. People used to leave by train, but now Russia hit a bridge and damaged some rail tracks, so now people can only leave by buses. It's just sort of deteriorating very fast. For Ukrainian army, it's obviously not a good situation that they are in now. There is one place where they are almost surrounded, so they are planning probably to withdraw from this area.
How much attention do you think the troops, when they're not fighting, when they actually have a bit of time, How much attention do they pay to the kinds of discussions that are happening in the West, in countries like the United States and the UK, about whether or not they should get weapons, and indeed whether or not they should be allowed to use the weapons to actually attack Russia?
People definitely pay attention to this, especially soldiers, because all those decisions can impact their lives. So I remember when there was US aid that was withheld for many months, which eventually actually led to fall of Avdiivka. When the aid finally came, it was like a weight off their soldiers. So there was a sigh of relief that finally things will get better. So now with the discussions about permission to strike Russian Federation, this conversation used to already taking place for quite some time. So they're not part of discussion all the time, but the soldiers definitely are waiting for the decision to take place. And I think they perceived it as a sort of hypocrisy of the West a little bit, because it's pretty clear that Russia perceives West as enemy as much as it perceives Ukraine as enemy. But Ukrainian forces are still kind of held captive to this decision in some ways, and it's handicapping their capabilities.
Patrick Yarach, well, the BBC's political editor, Chris Mason, is with the Prime Minister in Washington, and he joins us now from outside the White House. Chris, do we expect this subject is going to come up in the meeting?
Yes, this question around missiles and Ukraine is being addressed, is being talked about. I've just come from the blue room of the White House, Sean, where we were briefly invited in for what's known as the spray, where reporters pile into a corner of the room. We hear some broad-based words from the principals, as they're known, the Prime Minister and the President. We then shout a wall of noise of questions, most of which are ignored, and then we're kicked out. And then they start their talks proper. The canvas is wider than just missiles, and the canvas is wider than just Ukraine. They will talk about the Middle East, they will talk about China and AI and trade. But yes, the question around missile deployment is there, and there is a subtlety of difference between two of Kyiv's closest allies. There is a scepticism in the White House, particularly around the deployment of US missiles by Ukraine into Russia. The UK has been making an argument about the deployment of Storm Shadow, these Anglo-French missiles, and it would appear in the diplomacy that there is an attempt to get to a place where Ukraine's allies can line up behind a position where perhaps some of these missiles are granted authorization for deployment, probably the Anglo-French ones, but perhaps not the American ones, but with all sides amongst the allies maintaining a common public position. Welcome to the complex world of international diplomacy.
Yes, some would call it a compromise, others would call it a fudge, but it's probably the reality of a major alliance like NATO. No announcement then expected imminently on this, but do you think it is getting close? Because as we heard from Patrick Yarach there, people on the front line are listening and their morale is very directly affected.
Completely. Exactly that. So I think we are getting ever closer to it, yes. I don't think there won't be any announcements tonight. We'll hear from the Prime Minister shortly after these talks in the next hour or so. I think there'll be something of a holding position from him. It is possible, Sean, that there never will be an announcement, because today has proven something that is obvious, but nonetheless, when you see it, it is there to observe, which is that words matter too. We've seen Moscow picking today to make that announcement about the expulsion of British diplomats. That is no coincidence. It happened several weeks ago. So an announcement itself would be perceived as provocative. I think as and when a decision is taken, the first we're likely to know about it is when one of these weapons is deployed in Russia.
Chris Mason, our political editor in Washington. Thank you very much. We're listening to that in Frankfurt in Germany. It's Lieutenant General Ben Hodges. He was commander of the US Army in Europe for 3 years, the culmination of a near 40-year career in the American military. General Hodges, thank you very much for being with us on The World Tonight. Do you believe that allowing Ukraine to fire these missiles into Russia would make a material difference to this conflict?
Well, of course, it would absolutely make a difference in the conflict because, number one, it would enable Ukraine to destroy Russian headquarters, logistics, disrupt air operations, and it would destroy a lot of their artillery and rocket launchers. So that alone is a good enough reason to do this. But it also would signal that finally the United States is recognizing that the continuous Russian threats that they're going to do something are by and large empty. There is almost zero possibility that Russia would use a nuclear weapon, because there is no benefit for them to use a nuclear weapon. Their benefit comes from the threat of using a nuclear weapon. And so we should stop deterring ourselves, lift the restrictions, give Ukraine what they need to win, and then get the hell out of the way.
On that question of, you know, the threat from Putin, he's made these threats before. Kim Darroch, who was British ambassador in Washington, said he's bluffing until he isn't. And that's the difficult judgment, isn't it, the West has to make?
Well, that's always going to be the case, for sure. But I think there's enough evidence. We've been watching Vladimir Putin now for 20 years, and he has managed to do what he's done because we have never stood up to him. I mean, after the Second Chechen War, the West did nothing. After he invaded Georgia, the West did nothing, nothing of consequence. After he invaded Ukraine the first time in 2014, zero. After he jumped over Obama red line in Syria, nothing. And so you can almost imagine the Russians thinking, okay, the West is going to continue to not really do anything of consequence. We haven't turned off their ability to export oil, for example, to India, which has turned into a massive money laundering machine for Russia. So they don't think we're serious.
You can understand why there might be some public skepticism, never mind the political skepticism, though, can't you? Because at each stage, we've been assured by doing this, we'll make a difference. We give them tanks, it'll make a difference. We give them ammunition and weapons, it'll make a difference. But it still hasn't, none of it has made a significant difference to change the balance of the war to get us beyond a stalemate, an apparent stalemate.
I'm not willing to accept that characterization, but there is no one thing that is a game changer. The problem is we have drip, 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 everything that we've ever finally agreed to do. And it took the UK to pull the United States forward on several of these things. But still, I mean, here we are 10 and a half years after Russia first invaded Ukraine, 2.5 years after the large scale invasion. And we're arguing over whether or not to let them use Storm Shadow against the source from which Russians are killing innocent Ukrainian people. This is unbelievable to me. And the fact that we still have not used all of our economic tools to bring Russia to bear. So yes, of course, you know, one more tank, one more Patriot, one more HIMARS launcher by themselves are not going to change the outcome of the war. But each one of those things has increased Ukraine's capacity to defend itself. We have failed the most important task, which is to clearly identify the strategic objective. I mean, what the hell are we doing? Now, why are we doing it? And of course, I believe the reason we're doing this is to help Ukraine actually win this war. That's the best way to make sure that Russian aggression does not extend anywhere. And it also sends a message to the Chinese that we are serious about defending sovereignty, international agreements, freedom of navigation. These are the things that matter out in the Indo-Pacific region as well.
President Putin has also threatened satellites.
Okay. I mean, so what? I mean, he has been threatening everything. And, you know, I think he understands that he does not want to get into any sort of a conflict or a tit for tat with the United States, UK, and all the other countries of NATO or the West. I mean, our economies, our militaries, our populations dwarf what Russia has. But he's banking on the fact that we don't have political will. And so that's why he continues to do things such as sending missiles and drones that go through airspace, challenging us in international waters, disrupting elections. And we're not doing anything about it.
General Ben Hodges, former commander of U.S. Army in Europe. Thanks very much.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, they're expecting 8 days in space. By the time they return next year, they'll have been off-world for 8 months. The NASA astronauts Suni Williams and Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore spoke publicly for the first time in a broadcast this evening from the International Space Station. Ms. Williams was asked whether she'll be voting in the US presidential election in November.
Looking forward to being able to vote from space, which is pretty cool. You asked what we miss, right? Of course, you know, the things that we always miss, our families. I miss my two dogs. I miss my friends. There are so many people on Earth that are sending us messages, and it makes you feel just right at home with everybody when we're able to have those conversations with our friends and family at home. Everybody's cheering for us to get back.
They certainly are. Well, Colonel Katie Coleman knows something of what they're experiencing. She's a former NASA astronaut, author of the new book, Sharing Space. Colonel Coleman, thank you very much for being with us. They are sharing space for a lot longer than they planned. I just wonder, first of all, how important is it in terms of the psychology of doing a job like being an astronaut to know how long you'll be there and when you can hope to be back?
Well, I think that, you know, as astronauts and just really everyone at NASA and the contractors, we are ready for the mission, whatever the mission entails. And, you know, because we are doing things that are new and not easy, I think people have to be ready for the unexpected. That doesn't mean that it's easy. And I think in this case, it's hard. But we're always asking those questions, you know, what if they have to stay up there? Before they even launched, people were measuring, you know, do they have enough food if they have to stay, all those kinds of things. So you know that the big bases are covered. And so I think that, you know, I would say many of us who are former astronauts are just a little bit jealous. And but at the same time, watching Butch and Sonny up there, just knowing that they're really making such great use of the time while they're up there.
You say they're making great use of the time, and I'm sure they are. But presumably a lot of activity, in space is routine. Dare I say it, dull?
Well, Sonny has, her husband likes to say that space is her happy place. And she was describing in this press conference just things like, she said, you know, you do something ordinary, but you can do it from upside down or right side up or sideways. And it makes you realize that different perspectives are out there. And the same thing with doing, you know, grueling, she didn't say grueling, because she's really, really fit, but, you know, doing exercise from up there. And then you take a little break and you go and look out the window. And so there's a huge perspective shift that you get up there that makes you realize that life has a lot of different possibilities.
What did you take away from listening to them this evening?
It made me smile. And I was happy to hear from them. I was interested in what they had to say. Sonny said, you know, when it was going to be such a short mission, one of her big regrets was that 8 days was going to make it very hard to share the experience. And she was really happy about writing in a journal. Butch talked about, you know, his reflections on NASA values and people's values and how that and being mission oriented really helped him. And at the same time, you know, it was hard on his family and hard on him not to be present for his daughter's senior year. And, you know, and just, I mean, it's our families really, really, you know, help us out a lot. So there's always that part.
4 months, I think you were at one point in space, weren't you? Very near to 4 months. How big an adjustment was it getting back to Earth?
I was actually sad. It was actually almost 6 months, and some things came up where there was a question, and I would have spent another 6 months up there in a minute. And it's not that you don't want to come back to Earth. It's more about it's so clear, viscerally clear when you're up there, that every single data point you take is getting us a step further towards understanding how to be an interplanetary species. And I mean, the questions are big and hard, and it's just nice to be a part of that work.
Colonel Katie Coleman, thank you so much for talking to us about your time as an astronaut and about the experience. Your new book, Sharing Space, is out. Now, the High Court has quashed government consent for what would have been the first new coal mine in 30 years. West Cumbria Mining, which has spent 7 years campaigning for permission to cut a shaft to access coal reserves in Whitehaven, now has a few weeks to consider an appeal. Assuming that doesn't happen, it'll be for Angela Rayner, the Deputy Prime Minister, in her departmental role as Housing, Communities and Local Government Secretary, to decide whether or not to grant consent. The court ruled that the conclusion made by one of her Conservative predecessors, that the mine would not produce a net increase in greenhouse gas emissions, was legally flawed. There was cheering outside the High Court from campaigners who challenged the previous government's decision. These local people in Cumbria, though, weren't celebrating.
I think we should go ahead, really. I'd definitely do. It'll bring jobs, and plus, as I say, we need the coal, don't we?
My great-grandfather worked on the mines many, many years ago, so it's something that within my family it just always happened. So I think being brought up within that mindset, I personally don't see an issue.
I think it's good for the economy. I think it should happen. I think generation of jobs, why not?
Well, earlier we brought together Josh McAllister, who became Whitehaven and Workington's Labour MP at the general election. He opposed the mine. And Conservative Mike Starkey, who, in his time as Mayor of Copeland, campaigned in its favour. He told me how he was feeling after today's decision.
I'm feeling it's inevitable after the Labour government refused to defend the case in court, but I'm feeling, it's a crushing disappointment for me and the majority of the population who live in the community that I've grew up in my entire life. You know, every poll that we've run locally showed about 90% support for this mine, and it would have brought a huge economic boost to an area that desperately needs it, and it would have brought it immediately. One of the biggest frustrations is in this country, we elect people to make decisions on our behalf, and this decision today has been made by an unelected judge, and that just should never happen.
Josh McAllister, you're the new MP for Whitehaven and Workington, elected as part of Labour's big majority. It's a quite an odd position to find yourself in, isn't it? Celebrating the fact that a plant has been rejected that could have created 500, presumably much needed jobs for your constituents.
Well, I'm certainly not celebrating. I mean, look, this has been a...
But you were legally, against it, weren't you?
From the get-go, I've been really clear with people that I didn't think that the jobs from the coal mine would last if it ever made it to that stage. And the judgment from the High Court today backs that up. The last Conservative government made a legally flawed decision. And it's not just that one stage. This has been going on for 7 years. Mike and others, who I've got a lot of respect for, are coming at this because they want jobs and prosperity for the community, as do I. And the debate is, where's that opportunity going to come from? I've always been really clear that I don't think banking on jobs in a dying industry is going to deliver for our area.
Do you hope... stroke expect Angela Rayner, who will now have to reconsider this decision, to reject this deep coal mine? Is that what you are hoping for? Is that what you would expect a Labour government now to do in this situation?
My understanding is that there's about 6 weeks for the company to consider whether or not they want to appeal the decision. We're not through the legal process by any means yet. My hope is that we actually set out some tangible plans that will be delivered, that create jobs in new nuclear, in synthetic fuel production, through expansion of the Port of Workington, through data centres. There's lots of stuff coming down the tracks for the country if we seize it. And that's where our attention should be.
Mike Starkey.
I think on that point, you know, we need to come in and, this coal mine, we've got to remember, is backed by private investor money. So however long it lasts, you know, it's not going to rely on one penny of taxpayer money. You know, it's not going to rely on the government at any time. This is private investor money. And these private investors have the wealth to do this because they don't bet on duds. These jobs would have lasted a minimum of 25 years, and 25-year jobs that are starting at £70,000 a year, and the supply chain that will build up around it. And also the West Cumbria Mine's done all the work to go to government for the upgrade of the West Coast rail line, which the improvements of that line will help attract other industries in, and things that he's trying to do in the Port of Workington. The reality with coking coal, it is a product that remains in demand, and there's no viable alternative in the short term.
I just want to pick up on this point then of what happens now, because you've talked to us, Josh, about alternatives. But those are alternatives that lots of other parts of the country are going to be competing for. What are you going to do to ensure that some of those alternatives actually come to your constituency in Whitehaven and Workington?
Well, we've got the nuclear designated land, we've got the skill base, and we've got the willing community and heritage to play a leading role in new nuclear power generation. An issue which, again, was long promised under the last Conservative government. And after 14 years, we've been left with an 11th hour attempt by me and other Labour politicians to try and rescue this for West Cumbria. But new nuclear is absolutely something that we should be
doing. New nuclear is one. You mentioned lots of other things in the list you gave earlier, like data centres, for example. Those are things that there isn't a pre-existing workforce for. So you're competing with every other region in the country. And yours is a region that struggled economically in the recent past, hasn't it?
The opportunity we've got is by generating reliable, clean power through nuclear, which we've got unique capabilities as a community to provide. you open up lots of private sector opportunities in things like data centers or synthetic fuel production, or even indeed in some parts of the steel fabrication or steel making processes. So the best thing we can do for economic growth as a community is get as much clean, reliable energy onto the grid and for industrial use as possible. And that makes us very attractive for the private sector to come and invest.
Mike Starkey, what do you think of that? I mean, you do have the skills already, don't you, with nuclear?
I don't disagree with any of that. I'd love to see new nuclear here. And if they announced today that we're getting new nuclear, it just couldn't happen that quickly. You know, it's got to go through planning applications. And by the way, new nuclear, you know, I've been here before when we've gone through new nuclear, we're going to get the same protesters and the same wailing and squealing we've had over the mine, you know, Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, they're all anti-nuclear.
Mike and I can be on the same side of the fence on this one.
My prediction is Rachel Reeves' budget in October will reduce the funding for the NDA for Sellafield, so it'll be another kick in the teeth for this community.
Well, we'll wait and see
going to happen in the short term. And this mine could bring jobs quickly while all these other things are developed.
Mike Starkey, just one last thought. The government says that everything has to be focused on growing the economy. Do you think that thought should weigh on Angela Rayner's mind when she reconsiders this application, as she will be legally required to do, assuming the appeal process doesn't change the outcome?
Of course it should be leaning on a mine. You know, this is going to bring immediate growth in the short term to the West Cumbrian economy. You know, this decision today is strangling growth at birth. This decision today has implications far beyond West Cumbria Mine and Whitehaven. This has serious implications for the country in general. You know, even Mad Miliband has acknowledged there's got to be a transition period, but the pressure's really on him now. Yeah. To make this transition to this mad rush for net zero, that just simply isn't going to happen, and it's going to break the country.
Let me ask you just one final question, Josh McAllister, and that is this. We have had a week, and this is affecting people employed in Scotland, in Wales, and now in England, where first the Paul Talbot announcement, where the government didn't get what it was hoping for, but has come to a deal with the company. That will mean significant job losses. We've got Grangemouth, the closure of that refinery that would be 100 years old this year, with the loss of jobs in Scotland. Now we have this decision on a deep coal mine, a decision that Labour appears to support, that there shouldn't be such a coal mine. I mean, it's not a great look, is it?
We've only been in government for a matter of weeks, so I don't think people will look at the carnage that you've described in British industry and manufacturing and think reasonably that that's the fault of a government that's only weeks into power, that's also got a very strong track record of some initial steps. That's how we'll continue to govern.
Josh McAllister and Mike Starkey. Hard work never hurt anybody. You probably either used that phrase yourself or had it said to you by someone else. A new exhibition at the Wellcome Collection, which opens in London next Thursday, offers a different perspective. Hard Graft looks at the experience of those doing physical jobs, which, given a choice, most of us would avoid, and about the impact on the health of those workers. This afternoon, curator Cindy Sissoko took me on a tour as the finishing touches were being made.
So the exhibition is delving into the impact of work on the body and health of workers. And it is very much set across three different sections, which are the plantation, the street, and the home. And this section looks at the health and safety of agricultural work, plantation work, but also not only historically, but also today. And one series of work that connects us to that most deeply is by a Bangladesh artist called MD Fazla Rabi Fatik, who's been documenting the lives and working conditions of people on tea plantations in Bangladesh. So one of the photographs is of a hand that is severely injured, and this hand was injured through a tea processing machine, really focusing and outlining the severity of that injury. This section is looking at different forms of unregulated labour, such as sanitation work and sex work.
And so I was passed from one photographer to another, and eventually to a commercial profile on Gaydar, where prices, for me, began at £120 per hour.
Sex work is becoming increasingly more popular as an occupation, as young people for example, such as Mendes, who's in this video and very much speaking from a sermon that he wrote himself, speaking up of that experience of not having any other choices. This is what the condition of society are. I do not find employment that is fair. And sex work is a way to get quick money. We're really looking also at the violence that comes with that work. So this is a very precarious and very much unsafe environment in which they work most of the time.
Ensure sufficient slack. Keep cutting edges sharp.
So what we hear is the artist Lubaina Himit, who's recording herself saying a few quotes from British health and safety manuals that dates back from 1940s.
Maybe this maybe that we are looking at.
That was the artist preparing her exhibit.
Yes, and her name is Moitran, and Moitran has worked with the Voice of Domestic Workers, a choreography of sounds by clapping on their body, by clapping in their hands, singing, words as well. So it's very eclectic mix of different sounds that very much speak up to their labour, which is again very much focused on their hands. The hands, the clapping, as a release of tension, of stress, but also as a therapeutic element through sound and movement. For me, it was really important to outline marginalized forms of labor that really moved away from perhaps what we were most used to, office work, maybe factory work, etc., etc.
Do you think the fact that we no longer experience, and a lot of people don't experience these kinds of labours, they don't even have people in their families to experience this kind of labours, makes us perhaps a bit complacent about the hard graft that many people in this country and around the world are still enduring?
I hope visitors will be able to reflect on those occupations as very much existing right now. This manual labour, domestic workers, sanitation workers, waste pickers, sex workers, agricultural workers that feed us, all of these different chains of labour that are hidden, not spoken about. They might not be present in some of our families, but they are for many other people, and that's the histories that I wanted to tell.
That's curator Cindy Sissoko showing me Hard Graft, the Wellcome Collection's new exhibition, which opens in London on the 19th of September and runs until April next year. It's Prince Harry's 40th birthday this weekend. So what, you might ask? Well, it's his remark. I was anxious about 30, I'm excited about 40, which got us thinking at The World Tonight about the significance often attached to the move from one decade of our life to the next. Like Harry, lifestyle journalist Jessica Salter approached her 40th this summer with relish. Eleanor Mills, founder of Noon, a community of women in midlife, believes there's, to quote the title of her book, much more to come. But she warns many experience a bump in the road first. Jessica began her conversation with Eleanor by relating how life really does feel like it begins at 40.
I turned 40 on the 4th of July this year, and I'd already had it in my sights for the past year that this was going to be quite an exciting birthday. And I think it's because in your 20s, you're kind of really struggling to build your career, find your friends, trying to work out who you are. And for me, in my 30s, I had babies when I was 32 and 36. So my 30s felt a bit like a fog of new motherhood and, again, finding a new sense of self. And I just look at people in their 40s. It feels like a real decade where you can be yourself, explore your creativity, do brilliantly in all kinds of ways, or not, just be happy with where you are.
Eleanor Mills, you've been through your 40s and now into your early 50s.
Don't ruin it for me, Eleanor.
Go on, Eleanor, tell her what that experience is like and what may be about to change for her maybe just a few years down the line.
Oh, Jessica, well, I don't want to harsh your mellow, but I think you're in a kind of little lovely plateau period where your kids are kind of, you know, 6, 7, 8. Your parents are probably still fine. And I'm afraid that what happens, and this is a global trend in our late 40s, David Blanchflower finds that the happiness curve, you get to the bottoms out at 47. And the good news is it gets better again. But I think what happens is you hit teenage children, which is quite difficult. Our parents begin to fall apart. My research from my organisation, noon.org.uk, shows that by 50, over half of women have been through at least 5 massive life events.
What sort of events?
divorce, bereavement, redundancy, an elderly parent, you know, with dementia or something like that, a teen with some kind of anxiety disorder, financial troubles, bit of health stuff, you know, not to mention a bit of menopause. But the good news is, and I really want to say this, is that what we find is that the women who've been through the most, and that's why we call it a midlife collision, end up the happiest. They end up as happier than they've ever been. And that's true of this global research on happiness as well, that it comes up again. And then we get happier and happier in our 50s, 60s, kind of 70s, and it all gets good again. What we don't really see in our culture, and I saw it happen to me and I see it happen to all the women within my new network, is that they go into this kind of midlife maelstrom collision and no one really warns them that it's coming.
Jessica, what do you make of all of that?
Eleni, you're probably right that I am in this bubble where I've just got a little one who's finally sleeping through the night and I feel quite elated by that. But I am buoyed by the images that I see and the women ahead of me who are starting new careers at 50. And all of that landscape of our later life has been totally redefined. I think maybe in the past 40 felt like quite significant, but it feels young now still. I think the excitement comes from knowing that other people are doing amazing things later in life as well.
It's so lovely that you say that, because actually at 50, women don't have a sell-by date. You know, they're not on the shelf. We're not peaches, one wrinkle and we're done. We're coming into our prime. And there is this sense that you're like a teenager again because you're starting again, but, you know, maybe in your own house with nice sheets and posh tea, as one of the women put it to me. And that there is this whole sense that you can start again. But this bit between 50 and 75 is the kind of extra bonus, the bit that our parents didn't really have.
Jessica, mindful of that, can you think how you might prepare yourself for that 47 from the research and from what Eleanor has had to say through her own experience? Things get a bit rocky.
Well, actually, I have already been sort of thinking about that. I have been using 40 as a moment to have a reflection on where I am, where I want to be, not because anything is wrong right now, but because I just want to have a check-in now and prepare myself for future changes. Of course, I've got two daughters. I am thinking what they're going to be like as teenagers and how can I parent and what can I do now to kind of really buoy up our relationship so that we can weather what will be a storm. I do know that.
Jessica sounds incredibly wise, really kind of wise and strategic and forward thinking. And that's exactly, I think, the right thing to be doing. And to be aware that things don't stay the same. You know, change is evidence of life.
Jessica, it sounds like you share Prince Harry's optimism about that pivot point in your life.
Yes, and I suppose you're right that we are both, one of the only similarities, I think, are in the privilege of having children. So I can understand how that could be a concern if you wanted children and you were worried that there was a clock ticking. I can understand that, and I do have friends in that situation. But I did also want to reflect on what he said about the anxiety of turning 30.
Yes.
Again, I didn't feel it because I'm just the kind of person who celebrates every birthday. But there is so much pressure of these kind of 30 under 30 lists, and you've got to have made it by that point. And I think the point about getting to your other decades is there's no such thing. There's no 40 under 40 or 50 under 50. So there's less of this frenzy that you've got to be at a certain place, and it feels more like you can get to wherever you want at whatever time.
Eleanor, how are you feeling about the prospect, a few years off yet, of turning 60?
Well, I'm only 53, so that's a bit far off. But what I do see in my community is a whole load of women having an amazing time in their 60s, really saying it's their best decade ever. We have to be grateful for the fact that we're all living so much longer, really know that there's much more to come, but be prepared to pivot and change and do some work on ourselves as we go through the years. You know, I think Harry's had a pretty tough decade between 30 and 40. So I really hope for him, maybe his midlife U-bend came a bit earlier and he'll get happier from here on in.
Do we overthink these milestones?
I think they do have a big effect. 49 was a big year of everything really kind of changing. I was made redundant. My kids started to leave home. It felt pretty apocryphal. I think it's often the year before the big number when one really feels it.
I was going to say that people who've turned 41 find it a bit dreary, as if there's sort of nothing. But 40 and 50, I'm sure, are these big celebratory moments. It does feel like a chance to throw a big party.
Jessica Salter and Eleanor Mills definitely not marking time. Ours, however, is about to run out. Before we go, a quick look at some of Saturday's front pages. The Times headlines a quote from Ukraine's President Zelensky. Putin burns our cities as West delays. The paper says the Ukrainian leader has issued an urgent plea for long-range missiles. The Mail also quotes President Zelensky, "Stop delays and let us fire missiles into Russia," its headline says. But The Telegraph has "White House cold on Starmer's missile plan." The paper says the Prime Minister will leave Washington without any announcement on allowing Ukraine to fire long-range missiles into Russia. And that's The World Tonight. I'm Sean Lay, off for a couple of weeks. We'll be back with you at the beginning of October. The programme is back as normal on Monday. Good night.